Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, looking forward again to talking to this marvelous audience and to my guest today, who is one of the most esteemed, loved, and effective people I will ever have on the show, and I will tell you much more about him in a couple of minutes. Bert, are you there?
Yes, indeed I am, Peter. And I am delighted to be able to talk with you today.
That's really, really good. Well, let me give a little intro. I wanted to make sure you were there. Today, folks, I Skyped for 2 hours to a conference in Denmark this morning. It was morning for me, and I was closing the show for the people in Denmark. The movement is spreading. I mean, this was a really good audience, and with professionals in it, with survivors in it, and a lot of other really good speakers. And I'm going to be talking in London by Skype on Friday. One of the things about this that might be important to some of you who are actually listening to me is that while I may not always travel or want to travel to a conference, or it may seem like, you know, it's not a conference you think I might want to bother to come to, you can check it out with me. You know, call me at the office, at the office number, which is on my homepage and elsewhere, and see if we can arrange a Skype, because Skyping doesn't take a lot of effort. It's not that hard to set up. And in this case, you know, I was up on a big screen, and I could see the audience, and I really felt like I was there. So keep that in mind. Now, why didn't I go to Denmark, and why didn't I go to London? And I wanted to clear up just what's been happening health-wise. I am fine. I am perfectly healthy. But my wife, Ginger, who's now recovering and recovering fully from a small stroke. Gingy, a few weeks ago, had a little trouble speaking. It was very slight, only she and I could tell, but the doctors took it seriously. And it turned out that she had indeed had a recent very small stroke in that area. She is now speaking perfectly normal to her own perception and to mine, almost all the time, rare exceptions, maybe every few days. She's just getting better and better. I think in a week or so, she won't even notice it. She's singing again, which she loves to do. Mm-hmm. She's tired and doing some recovery, and I'm just not going to leave my loved one's side, so I canceled those trips. But some people thought, since I'm the old one in this family, I mean, God, I'm going to be 80 next birthday, they thought something had happened to me. But it didn't. It happened to my loved one. And I just think I'm glad to be here to help take care of her, as she always takes care of me in whatever way I need. And someday maybe we'll have a show just about loved ones. That would be an interesting show. I'm doing well. She's doing really, really well. You would not notice anything, even if you were a very close family member, and we're talking to her now. She's on the exterior, completely recovered, and her brain is saying, you need to rest a bit, Gingy. So she's doing some resting. My wonderful guest today, Bertram Caron, K-A-R-O-N. Ginger and I think so much of Bert that when we set up a number of years back our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living, we gave Bert the award as the first recipient. So that tells you that when I thought, who would I want to honor, first person came to our minds, both of us, was Bert. Now, we're not the first to honor Bert. I'm going to not list all the other less important big awards he's gotten from the American Psychological Association and the humanistic psychologists and so on. But Bert's had a lot of awards. He's been a teacher, of course, for many, many years. And all over the country and the world, there are students who speak of the importance of his influence. Bert is both a clinical psychologist and a psychoanalyst. By the way, he and I both went to Harvard, and he went off to Princeton after that to get his Ph.D. He's written a very important book, The Psychotherapy of Schizophrenia, The Treatment of Choice. It's a landmark in his field. He's written innumerable papers, and he and I did a conference together with the help of Ginger and his assistant Cindy at his university on the campus of Michigan State not very long ago. And at that conference, Bert speaking, he asked me to arrange the speaker, and then right away I arranged for him to speak. I've actually had Bert speak at a number of my conferences. I learned something new about him, that he was very inspirational for the best intervention in the world that we know of today for treating people who are having their first breakdown, usually as a young person. And that's the famous Lapland program in Finland, which you can look up, and which I've talked about and written about in my books, and which you can look up as Open Dialogue. Open Dialogue will get you there. And I've talked about it on other recent shows. Well, what I found out at the conference from a representative of Open Dialogue was that Bert had actually visited this program before it really got its wings and gave them a lot of encouragement and inspiration in developing that program. So his reach is far and wide. I'm just so glad to have you on the show. Welcome, Bert Caron. It's really, really so nice to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's really, you know, there isn't anybody in this field that I respect more than you. And I'm glad that Ginger is feeling better.
What? Yes. Thank you, Bert. Go ahead.
What did you start talking about?
I had one thing I forgot to add, you know, because the show starts out calling me the conscience of psychiatry. Guess who named me the conscience of psychiatry?
It was
Dr. Bertram.
Because you deserved it. Because you have done more to make sure that psychiatry does things for people that help them instead of doing things that hurt them. And, you know, I first heard of you when you were the expert witness in the court case here in Michigan that ended the use of lobotomy. Not only it ended the use of lobotomy with that court case in Michigan and within a year in the rest of the United States. And then after that, you wrote about electric shock treatment, and you have written innumerable books on medications and their harmful effects, and always, always you get the facts right. I've heard cases where people attacked you, and in every single case, when I went back to the original sources and checked the literature and the research, you always have the facts right, and the people who objected to you don't. And that's impressive as hell.
Thank you, Bert. But Bert was very, very important to me in that I didn't know him when my license was attacked during the 1980s, but he'd been following my work. And someone said, well, call Bert Caron. He'll be brave enough to write a letter to the licensure people, because we didn't have a lot of full professors, you know, with all the accolades supporting my reform work, especially in those days. And Bert was the first professor who had, you know, any real esteem in the community of the academics to come forward and to back me up. And I think that had a big effect on licensure people. And of course, we won the licensure battle. But I've been grateful to Bert ever since then.
It's always
Bert, let
good.
Me just give it to you to talk a while, and I'm going to be quiet. Talk about what something you'd like to just delve into.
Well, I don't know, about the treatment that people deserve. And the treatment that people deserve is competent psychotherapy. Years ago, a graduate student in experimental psych came up to me and told me about a friend of his that was hospitalized. He had seen a psychiatrist who sort of tried talking with him and gave him medication, and he got worse. And then, so he increased the medication, and he got worse. And he increased the medication, and he got worse. Then he was hospitalized, and they increased his medications and gave him multiple meds and increased the dosages, and he kept getting worse. And then they told his wife and him that he was a hopeless schizophrenic. The only hope he had was electric shock treatment. Probably wouldn't help him, but it was the only hope he had. And this friend of his asked me about him, and I said, "What? Number one, stop, withdraw permission for electric shock. Number two, get him out of that hospital. All he needs is a competent therapist." Well, I talked to his wife, and she did just exactly that. She told him to, she withdrew permission for shock treatment and took him out of the hospital and brought him to my office. And the first session was in my office as soon as he got out of the hospital. And indeed, he was a very sick man. He was not sleeping, not eating, continuously hallucinating, and he could hardly stand. I worked with him for an hour, and then of all those symptoms, the only one that will kill you is not eating, but it doesn't kill you right away. So I did what I've written about in treating people who don't eat. You have a meal with them, either eating the same meal or choosing from the main same menu. At 7 o'clock the next morning, we went to an all-night restaurant, and he said, "I can't go in there. They'll think I'm crazy." And I said, "No, they won't. They'll think you're drunk." And he said, "But I'll throw up." And I said, "Well, you won't be the first drunk that threw up here tonight." We went in there. I had breakfast, and he told me how terrible it was. The second day, however, he took a cup of black coffee. The third day, he had coffee and toast. The fourth day, he ate breakfast and then said, "I'm paying for therapy. Let's, and all I do is come here and watch you eat." Well, by that time, his eating wasn't a problem, and we moved to the office. 3 days is all it took to get him eating. 6 months later, he was back at work as a college professor. This is the incurable schizophrenic. All he needed was a competent therapist. And that's all that most people need, is a competent therapist. And the we have a lot of mental health professionals who really aren't competent therapists. I know ones who have never seen any patient. Not just the very difficult ones that I talk about and that Peter talks about, but any patient get better. But all that people really need is competent therapy, and that means one that starts with your problems and helps you understand them and helps you understand yourself and keep growing. And a long time ago, Sigmund Freud was asked what it took to be normal. And he said, "All you have to do is be able to love, be able to work, and be able to enjoy." And really, that's all it is. It takes to be normal, but that's quite a lot. And that's the aim of psychotherapy. Now, in addition, people have specific symptoms, like hallucinations and delusions and obsessions. And all of those you can deal with, and all of them, when you find out what they're all about, get better. The amazing thing is that people do get better if they are worked with. Now, that doesn't mean when somebody comes in who's sick that you understand what they are concerned about, that you understand the meaning of the symptoms. You don't. They're often extremely difficult to understand, and you have to be able to work with them and tolerate the fact that you don't understand and work with what you do understand And the patients are often surprised if you understand anything, because they've often talked to mental health professionals who didn't understand anything or didn't listen very carefully. And one of the reasons that mental health professionals like to give medication is because they don't feel that they're able to help anybody. But if you can tolerate it, people, and you will understand, and so will the patients, and they do get better. Now, I can give you some examples from some difficult patients that I have worked with. I remember the first schizophrenic patient I ever saw. I was doing an internship at a place that worked with chronic schizophrenics. He'd been psychotic for years. And when he was brought to the place, I came in to see him, and he sat on the bed and clicked, just made a clicking noise. Now, I hadn't a clue. There's no way I could know what the devil that was about. I reached out my hand, and he fell off the bed like he was made of wood. But he got up and ran to a corner of the room. I followed him. He ran to another corner of the room. I followed him, and he said, "Don't hit me! Don't hit me! Don't hit me!" And I said to him, as anyone would, "I'm not going to hit you. I promise you, I'm not going to hit you." And he said, "Not you," and he pointed to the center of the room, him. Presumably, he saw somebody terrifying there. So I turned to the center of the room, really not knowing what to do, but then I threatened him that if he didn't leave this boy alone, the man was actually in his 30s, I then described some horrible things that I read in a book on Malay magic that Malay witch doctors use in threatening demons and evil spirits. And when I threatened whoever him was, he suddenly relaxed. And I said to him, "Well, he's gone." And he said, "Yes." And then he began talking to me. And then the therapy really began. And but I couldn't possibly know what was going on. And now the clicking sound, I didn't know what it was about. Later, as we talked, and it took about 6 months for me to find all this out, the clicking actually was short for the word best. And the word best was short for the phrase 3-4 infinity best. And the word and the number 3, which kept coming to his mind, stood for a penis. And the word and the number 4, which came to mind, stood for a world where there were no penises and where there was no sexuality and his mother would love him. It took us 6 months to discover all that, but when we discovered it, the symptom of clicking and the symptom of the number 3 coming to mind many, many, many times every hour, both stopped. And that's what happens when you have people in therapy. If you can tolerate the fact that you don't understand and do your best, eventually you will understand, and so will the patient, and the patient will get better. It's been my experience that just about everybody I've ever worked with has gotten better. Now, sometimes they don't go as far as I would like them to go, but it's their lives, not mine. But I don't think I have ever really worked with a patient who stayed for more than a couple of sessions who didn't get really marked benefit out of talking with me. And if you've ever worked with a truly psychotic patient who gets better, if someone who can't live independently now lives independently, if someone who can't work now works, if someone who can't go to school now goes to school, if someone who can't take care of their kids now takes care of their kids, those are not subtle changes. And once you've seen one patient do that, it is a benign trauma for the therapist from which you never recover. The next time you have a difficult patient, you remember what happened, and you know that if you do the best work you can do, the patients will get better. Anyway, that's what I know about my field, and it's very important, because if the therapist doesn't have hope, and we have a lot of so-called therapists who tell patients, well, you have this genetic disease, even though the evidence is that nothing has been shown to be genetic in psychiatric disorders, which is incurable, and with the best of modern treatment, by which they usually mean medication, we can make you bearable by other people. But in fact, there's nothing about that statement, those statements, that would give any reasonable person hope. On the other hand, if you let patients know that, yes, they can get better, yes, they are seriously ill, they do have serious problems, and it's going to take a lot of hard work. But I usually tell people, you're not afraid of hard work, and it's true. They're not. People are afraid of meaningless work. But if you're willing to do the work, you will get better. And in fact, if they do the work, they do get better. Well,
let's talk a little more about the hallucinations. I have done some similar things where
hallucinations. I remember I've heard professionals say things like nobody understands hallucinations, and of course it's not true. Hallucinations are waking dreams. We all hallucinate when we're asleep, but you have to be very sick to hallucinate when you are awake, so the motivation has to be higher. But as you know, therapists use dreams in therapy. That it's not an accident that Sigmund Freud's first book on his own was The Interpretation of Dreams, because he found that when people talked about dreams and then associated to them, he got to their problems often quicker. So anyway, if they hallucinate, what you do is tell them, ask them to describe the hallucinations in as much detail as they're willing to do. Now, when we dream at night, you can hallucinate in any sensory modality, just as you can dream in any sensory modality. But most dreams are visual. But most hallucinations are auditory. They hear voices. And patients don't like you to call it hallucinations because they find that demeaning. But if you ask them about the voices, they will tell you about the voices. And if they tell you about the voices, then you treat it just as you would with a dream. You take each detail and you say, what comes to mind? And if you do that, their associations will tell you what the voices are all about. And the reason, by the way, that you hear voices is because these disorders are interpersonal difficulties. And as we probably know, people who are deaf have more emotional problems than people who are blind, because if you can't hear people, it cuts you off from other people. Well, these disorders have to do with relations with people, which is why most of the hallucinations are voices. I think I've said most of what I have to say about voices and about hallucinations, but they are treatable. And the notion that you just leave them alone is silly. If someone has a symptom and it's bothering them, then it needs to be paid attention to. And if you do pay attention, and if you listen, you and the patient can work out what it's all about. And when you do, the hallucinations stop.
Let me ask you a question about hallucinations.
Sure.
It's a hard question for me to formulate.
That's all right. Oh, by the way, I will tell you one thing. If the hallucination is the voice of God, you have to be very tactful. Patients have assaulted me when I told them that the voice was not the voice of God, and that makes perfectly good sense. I mean, suppose you had a direct line to God and someone was trying to take it away from you. Wouldn't that make you mad? Well, of course it does. So if the voice is the voice of God, you have to be very tactful, unless the voice of God tells them to kill themselves or someone else. Then you have to say, that is not the voice of God, because God is not a sadist. You have to make it make sense, what you say, and make sense in terms of what they know and what their experience is. I'm sorry, but you had some further questions about hallucinations.
I think one of the few things you and I disagree on is the voice of God, because I do think this is a universe beyond our understanding, and that it is entirely possible that there may be something that happens, some communication between God or the designer, so I just want to put that in. I know you and I disagree about that, but I think it's always a loving voice. I think when I think, well, maybe that's God's voice. But when I read about the saints who have heard God's voice, it's a loving voice. It's an inspiring voice. And it doesn't usually come during a terrible crisis. It usually comes out of the blue. But so much for a very complicated... But I had a question that I puzzle over in working with people. A lot of times it's possible to actually see hallucinations, including visual ones and ones where of touch and feeling, right back to early child abuse, to early trauma.
Right.
There is a very powerful pressure within an individual not to see hallucinations as unreal, and not to see them as coming from the unconscious, when it can be really helpful for them to see, well, that voice accusing you is exactly the voice you described your mother and your father having. It may sound a little different, but they're saying the same thing, that you're just horrible and that you shouldn't be alive and don't talk to the doctor and other kinds of things. Can you talk some about the process whereby people come to grips with, in your experience, with the fact that hallucinations are in fact unreal, and in fact are really being driven through our brains by past experiences?
Yes, well, of course, I must tell you, I've even had patients who hear my voice as a hallucination, and the only way I knew about it is they quoted me as saying things that I know I would never say. And then I said, well, where did you get that? And they said, well, you said it. And I said, well, where did I say it to you? And then they would tell me something like, well, I was in my bedroom and I heard you talking to me. But, you know, what comes to mind is one patient who came in and he had out-of-body experiences where he, you know, flew out of his body. And then he said to me, you don't believe me. Well, I do not want to insult him. On the other hand, I also didn't want to lie to him because I'm not very good at lying. So I said to him, look, I find it highly improbable, but I wasn't there and you were. Tell me about it. And so he did. Months later, as he was telling me, as we talked about many things, he was telling me about having an out-of-body experience when he started going toward the moon, which looked down at him like a large face with a very pleasant smile on it. And I said, well, you know, I have an idea about that. And he said, what is it? And I said, well, it's not your way of understanding it. He said, yeah, but what is it? And I said, well, it sounded to me, as you described that face, like a baby being lifted. And he finished my sentence in his mother's arms. And he got all excited because it made more sense to him that way. And as he went on, all of his out-of-body experiences made much more sense to him. And as they made more sense to him, he got better. And, of course, he was with me. But the key thing is that you have to be on the patient's side. If the patient's confused, it's okay to be confused. If the patient thinks you're an idiot, it's okay to be for the patient to think you're an idiot. You know, about 2 years ago, I was teaching a seminar to a group of psychoanalytic candidates on Sigmund Freud's papers. And so I had to reread those, his collected papers, which I had read many years earlier. And I read something in them that somehow I had missed. And, of course, one of the reasons that Freud made so many discoveries is he did listen very carefully. And he said, when a patient stops talking and doesn't say anything to you and doesn't explain why, the odds are that the patient is angry at you and doesn't want to say so. Well, I didn't remember reading that. But after that, I was listening to a patient who stopped talking. I didn't say anything. And then I said, I wonder if you're angry at me and don't want to tell me that. And it turned out that that was exactly what was going on. And when that patient began to feel free to be angry at me, the therapy went on. And I have heard that since in several people, including one person who had seen several other analysts without ever being able to get help. And it turns out that with each one of them, the patient would stop talking and never tell the therapist that he was angry at the therapist. And once he was feel free to tell me how angry he was at me, the treatment has gone very well ever since. So, but it's a question of always getting people to describe their experience in as much detail as they're willing to do, and assuming it makes sense, and then trying to listen to it to help them make sense of their own experience. And eventually, they will accept the way you understand things because it makes more sense to them than the way they had understood it before. And that's the way you want it. It's not true because you say it. It's true because it makes more sense to them.
Talk some more about what do you think the best attitudes of the therapist are? What should people expect from a therapist in the way of attitudes toward them?
Well, I think that, first of all, you have to have respect for the other person as a person. That you have to feel that people are worthwhile, and that if they are hurting, then you want to do something about it, and you do want to treat them. You don't want them to have to spend their life just hurting. The other thing is that you are willing to go anywhere, to consider anything that they need to bring up. You will be willing to think about anything, even things that you don't want to think about, that you don't like to think about, things that make you uncomfortable. But you have to be willing to go there if that's what the patient needs. And the other thing you have to do is share with the patient the feeling of hope. They've usually had nothing in their life to give them hope. And unfortunately, they may have seen therapists or doctors who have told them that they have no reason to hope for anything good. And you have to provide hope. If they get the feeling from you that you, in fact, expect good things to happen, they begin to consider that maybe good things can happen. And when they notice changes in themselves, then they do get that feeling of hope from you that has been missing for a long time in their life.
What do you think about the role of love? You know, I talk about love a lot, and what do you think about it in healing?
Oh, I think that unconditional love, as it's sometimes talked about, is exactly what we're talking about. It's what helps people. The feeling that they really are accepted and cared about, that no matter what they do, that they are cared about. And now, that doesn't mean that you love them when they do horrible things. Well, I mean, I was thinking of one man who committed serial murders. Obviously, nobody in their right mind is going to love him until he started changing. This was many years ago. He was seeing a psychiatrist. He was in a reformatory. He described several murders that he had committed. The psychiatrist tried to turn him in and discovered that he could not be convicted unless he confessed. And while the patient was psychotic in many ways, he was not willing to confess. That ended the therapy with that psychiatrist, who then recommended maximum sentence for him. But he was in jail for something where the maximum sentence of breaking an entry would have been 2 years, after which he'd come out a better trained criminal, but he would be every bit as dangerous or be even more dangerous. So I took him into therapy because it was the only way to protect society. And I worked with him. And in many ways, he was very difficult. I could tell you some of the difficulties. For example, in one session, I was listening to him talk, and he leaned over, and he'd hidden a nail, and he took the nail and jabbed it into my knee. So, as you would expect, I blew up at that point and offered to throw him the hell out of my office. My office was, and not out the door. My office was on the third floor of that building. After I blew up, however, I said to him, you know, let's look at what happened here. I'm the only person in this building who doesn't hate you, and there must be something scary about that if you have to go this far to make me hate you. And then we went from there to his father because of things that he had said earlier, and how cruel his father had been to him when he was a child. And then he began to put together the reasons he had hurt other people. And by the way, he had figured out how to murder people and get away with it. You murder people where there's no motive to connect you with, where it isn't for profit, it isn't because of a relationship. He killed people that he met for the first time when he killed them. And he was able to get away with it. And he was not the least bit likable or lovable in any way. However, when he began to get better and he began to feel guilty about what he had done, then he became likable. And I only worked with him for maybe 6 to 9 months. And then I recommended he be discharged with mandatory therapy as a condition of parole. And they said, we never do that. You know what that would mean? It would mean if he stopped therapy without the agreement of his therapist and his parole officer, he'd be back in jail in 24 hours. And I said, that's exactly what I mean. However, about 3 years later, he did come back to the jail. He was still earning a living, breaking and entering. However, he wasn't killing people anymore, and both he and I felt it was a very successful treatment because he wasn't doing the god-awful things he did before. Now, in general, most people are not that hard to love. Most people are actually quite lovable when you get to know them, and they often do very bad things because of the bad things that were done to them. And all of that, the more you understand people, the easier it is to love them. And, you know, I don't think you're the first good therapist who has said that unconditional love was what cures people. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that's really true.
One of the puzzles of my life as a therapist and a person is how some people as children endure the worst, most horrific abuse and never lose sight of wanting to be good and to do good in the world and never to harm other people, whereas other people will endure horrendous abuse and become horrendous abusers. I even know of people who have been through similar abuse.
Yeah.
And one turns out to be this lovely human being who really cares about people. What are your thoughts on that? I think it's a puzzle. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm afraid it's puzzling to me, too. I really don't know. It usually turns out to me that no matter how horrible people are, eventually, if you listen to them, it all makes good sense. But there are people who have had similar experiences who don't get destroyed. I don't think I've ever studied anybody like that, but I can believe that they exist.
Oh, I have worked with patients, clients who I feel that if I'd gone through what they went through, I would not be a good person afterward.
Uh-huh. And, no, well, I have felt.
And very early on, they seem to make decisions that they want to be good people.
Uh-huh.
Well, without any model, any known model.
Uh-huh. Well, that's all I can say is that's very interesting, Peter, and I really haven't known anyone like that, but I believe they exist. And if you have seen them, then I know they exist.
Oh, yes, they definitely exist. In my experience. And it makes me, again, wonder about something more spiritual going on in the universe that I can't explain.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people are born, and they just take for granted when they're abused, some people, that's the model they won't ever inflict on anybody else. They decide early on, as horrible as they're being treated, that's how they will never treat another human being. And it's a very interesting phenomenon.
I have seen that, but that is people deciding that I won't ever do to my kid what was done to me. But usually have not been, you know, the people I know who have done that have not been as severely abused. But on the other hand, if you've seen them, they exist.
This is turning into a very interesting hour. I've never had an hour before where an experienced therapist simply talked about some of the most interesting cases and drew interesting conclusions from them. I'm hoping that this will be something that folks listen to a lot. And we've got about 15 minutes left. Let's stay on this wonderful topic of you being a therapist and what you've learned from it. Anything else, Bert, immediately come to mind?
Well, all I know is that I have been in a number of situations where people didn't expect patients to get help. And when patients were offered help that was real, they accepted it and they grew. When I worked in a reformatory for a while, and the patients there were expected not to get better, but they did get better. if they were offered reasonable help. If they weren't offered reasonable help, of course, then they didn't get better. But it does make a difference if you expect that you're there to help people and that people will get better if you do your best. And that means tolerating that you don't understand what's going on if you don't understand it, and frequently you won't. Tolerating that they at times treat you badly. Actually, let me tell you about one. Depressed people are very good at convincing you that nothing you do is of any help to them. And that that you can't help them, that their life is impossible, and that nothing you do is of any help. And they're very convincing. But the fact of the matter is they hope they don't convince you, even though there's no evidence that they that's what they want. And people who are depressed are always angry. And one of the ways the anger comes out is in the fact that they try to make you feel worthless and helpless, because that's what someone has done to them at some time in their life. But again, if you don't accept that view, if you keep working on the assumption that if you and I keep working, things are going to get better, even though the patient does their best to convince you that you're wrong. And the fact that depressed people have hostility is when I, again, have worked in several institutions, when a depressed person, when something bad happens to the depressed person, the staff laughs as long as nobody can blame them for the bad thing that happens. So, for example, in one place, when depressed people have put in given ECT, the staff laughed. If they were given psychotherapy or medication, the staff didn't laugh. But it was clear that when something bad happens to a depressed person, people feel good because the depressed person is expressing their hostility in their depression and using it as a way of hurting other people. And, of course, the depressed person denies that that's what they're doing. But that's what they're doing. And if you can take the view that you're there to help and that you will help if you keep working and if they work at it, eventually they do get better.
Would you, Bert, like to say something about the science behind all this in the sense of researching it? You wrote the definitive book.
Sure. Look, the fact of the matter is that many years ago, I did a controlled study comparing randomly assigning patients who were severe schizophrenics to medication and some support, medication plus psychotherapy, and psychotherapy without medication. And the findings were very dramatic. The group of patients who did best were those who got psychotherapy with no medication at all. Those who got psychotherapy plus medication did better than those patients who just got medication. But they didn't do as well as those who did not receive medication at all. Better than those who had continuing medication were those who got psychotherapy plus medication to begin with that was discontinued as soon as the patients could tolerate it. Now, that was not as good as not using medication at all, but it was much better than psychotherapy and continued medication. And that was our finding. Now, that's one set of studies that are very dramatic. You mentioned, I think, the Open Dialogue people in Finland. There, they have done incredible work. I think they get something like 80% recovery without using medication within a year or so. But they see the patients immediately. They provide family therapy and individual therapy if their patient is psychotic. And the family therapy is started as follows, because people in the families were always afraid that they're going to be picked on or blamed. What they say is, 6 months ago, your husband, your wife, your son, your daughter wasn't psychotic. Now they are. Something must have happened. Can you help us try to figure out what happened? That's how they start the group therapy. Getting on the same side as the family. And if the patient's psychotic, the patient also needs individual therapy. But the people doing it are all very decent, kindly people, actually. And their results are just absolutely brilliant. And that's in Finland. There's also data from here, well, there's data from Italy where when they made psychoanalytic therapy available with two to five sessions a week for 2 to 10 years with a median frequency of 3 times a week and a median length of time of 5 years, 80% of the patients got better. And that was using, actually, therapists in training who were supervised by experienced people. The fact of the matter is, without treatment, 30% get completely better in 20 years. With treatment, you should be able to do better. But if you give medication, the 30% don't recover. There's studies showing that where, Courtney Harding did a long-term follow-up study in Vermont and found that 50% of the patients stopped taking their medication. The 30% and 30% of the patients fully recovered. All of the patients who fully recovered were patients who had stopped taking their medication. No patient who kept taking their medication as long as their psychiatrist told them ever had a complete recovery in that study. Now, that's some of the data that's out there. Now, there's a very good book summarizing all of this by a journalist named Robert Whitaker. It's called The Anatomy of an Epidemic, and it presents all of this data in a very convincing form about what happens when people get real treatment versus what happens when they get only medication. And the results with only medication are not very good for almost any disorder.
You did more than I imagined you could do in 5 minutes then, Bert. Before we get near the end, I want to just remind people who we're talking to, because usually I interrupt more and remind people who we're talking to, but you have just been flowing with such interesting stories and information. We're talking to Bertram Caron, K-A-R-O-N. Bert's a PhD clinical psychologist, a psychoanalyst, a man who has been in the field a very long time, and goes back to a day when the psychotherapy of very disturbed people was taken very seriously and done very well with a great deal of success before the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry took it all over and decided literally, you can't talk to schizophrenia, you can't talk to disturbed people, and so on. I also want to mention just in a minute that although Bert uses a lot of traditional language when he talks about things like schizophrenia and so on, he is by no means a fan of the diagnostic manual. Maybe since you've been talking in traditional clinical terms, maybe you could just comment on that. Now, I understand that, Bert, you're not there anymore. We had a disconnect. We may get him back, but we've only got 3 more minutes to go. So I think that I can just fill in some more about these issues. There's just no question at all, folks, that the most disturbed people can and are helped by therapeutic human interventions without medication. We have Soteria House, which you can also Google, which was by Lauren Mosier, who's no longer with us, that demonstrated that people sent to a mental hospital randomly versus being sent into a residential home setting, that the people in the home setting did much better, and being treated by people who were basically untrained therapists selected by a social worker for their ability to be non-coercive and to listen and to care. So this was not even a high-priced alternative. And again, folks did better. And one thing we haven't emphasized, not only do people with psychotherapy and family interventions and social interventions do better, they don't get all the horrible diseases of the drugs. We haven't said enough about that. They don't get tardive dyskinesia disfiguring them and causing them a lifetime of pain. They don't get the severe obesity, the diabetes, the pancreatitis, the elevated cholesterol, the shortened lifespan, really early death that all the new antipsychotic drugs are doing. So, Bert, we lost the connection with Bert, but I'm just happy to draw to a conclusion to say you've been listening to a master class in psychotherapy and with enormous scientific background from Bertrand Caron, who is and always was way ahead of his field. And Bert, thank you so much for being on my show. Bye-bye, folks. I hope you enjoyed this.